Vika said, becoming distant. "Aye, there's a tale. I roamed further into the Shadowlands than I've ever gone before. I saw castles in the air that crumbled to rubble, even as they rebuilt themselves in new forms. I saw lakes of fire and ice, and beasts that held no shape. I saw cities under a black sun, aswarm with ghosts, and streets that parted before me like waves before the bow of a ship. In time I came to the gates of Kar Vishnak, the great citadel that guards the outsiders in their prison, which hangs suspended by chains over an abyss without end. I knocked upon the gates and was given entrance to where the torments walk in clinking robes, and the screams of the tortured echo from the depths."
"And what did you learn there?" Garrick asked gravely. "Among the torments?"
"Much and more, and none of it good," said Vika, her eyes intense behind her curtain of hair. Ruk whined and put her head on her mistress's lap. "The divide between this world and the Shadowlands is thinner than it has been since the days of the Second Empire, and it is thinning by the day. This is no natural waning. Something, somewhere, is causing this. Chaos grows and grows close. Urd shaman are uncovering lost arts in the lowlands. In the south, the chimericists, so long only charlatans and fakes, have learned how to breathe life into their creations. The theocracy of the Incarnate tightens its grip to the west, and the witches of Skarathun find their scattered bones tell the truth more often than ever before. I fear the Dreadnights are only a glimpse of what is to come. Something stirs and brings the doom of the world with it. We are no longer fighting for Ossia. We are fighting for everything." Aaron felt a chill seep through him as she spoke, and it seemed to him that the lamps in the room darkened. There was a fervour in her voice, and a look of madness in her eye, yet it was impossible not to believe her. There was a knock at the door, and the spell was broken. Laria came in with food and wine for Vika.
"With compliments of the Lady of the House," she murmured,
eyes downturned, her voice a soft lisp.
"She hopes you regain your strength soon."
"Please send her my thanks," said Vika, bright and polite, as if the dire warning of moments before had never been spoken. Laria bowed and hurried out while Vika fed a piece of chicken to Ruk.
"What does it all mean?"
Fenn asked when Laria was gone.
"I do not know," said Vika, "but I know this. The Dreadnights must be stopped. The Crodans are meddling with forces they do not understand. They are fools to believe they can control them."
"Is there no good news?" Aaron asked.
"Do not despair," said Vika. "The battle is far from lost. We have been warned, and forewarned we are forearmed. I have been touched by the taint of Plague's arrow, and learned from it. I know the nature of our enemy now. The Ember Blade is within our reach, and we still have our champion, who will seize the bright blade and lead us to victory." At this, her eyes went to Garrick, and Aaron saw a zealot's light there. Garrick grunted.
"I know nothing of visions," he said, "but I will bring ruin upon the Crodans, I promise you that."
They heard footsteps on the stairs, and Garrick, still in the doorway, looked away to find their source.
"We must go," they heard Keel say. "It's time."
Garrick nodded and turned back to Vika.
"Farewell, Vika. I'm glad I got to see you safe before I left. Farewell, Cade. Fenn. Aaron."
Aaron heard the unspoken meaning in the way Garrick said his name, a reminder and an acknowledgement of what had passed between them.
"I go now to take the first step to a free Ossia. Aspects go with me."
"Aspects go with you," Cade and Vika said together. Fenn echoed them quietly. Garrick headed downstairs with Keel, leaving Aaron staring at the empty doorway. How different things might have been between them if he'd known the truth about the Hollow Man. When Garrick returned, he was determined to begin again, properly this time. But Vika had a suspicious look on her face, and he knew she'd noticed something that Aaron hadn't.
"What is it?"
he asked her.
"Nothing,"
she lied.
79. There were no moons that night, and racing streaks of cloud obscured the stars as the carriage clattered across the sleeping city, passing through islands of light cast by street lamps. Where the up lanes ended in the equally exclusive streets of Consort's Rise, Clea pulled the horses to a halt. They'd walk from here. Hooded and cloaked in the driver's seat, she waited silently while Garrick and Keel climbed out, swords at their hips. There was no point carrying their weapons wrapped up. They clearly had no business in such an exclusive district at this hour, and no passes would spare them if they were seen. Between a fight and an arrest, they'd take their chances on the former. Stealth was the watchword now. Clea shook the reins, and the carriage rolled away, leaving the two of them in the shadows. In the distance, they heard the great bell of Broor Tam begin to clang, ringing dolefully across the hills.
"Seventh bell of dark," said Garrick. "Let's be about it, then."
They set off into Consort's Rise, where wide leafy avenues gave way to winding paths and steps as the land steepened sharply. The houses were narrow but imposingly tall, piled up alongside one another behind stone-walled gardens. Those windows that were lit revealed glittering chandeliers and elaborate plaster cornices, harpsichords and dining tables, pastel walls in the Croydon style. They hurried upwards, heading for their rendezvous with Wilhelm and his men, and the vintner's yard beyond. Keel had spoken little on the journey, and said even less now, for which Garrick was thankful. There would be dark business tonight, and he was eager for it to be over. It saddened him that his friend had become a liability, but there was no denying the truth. Keel had been used up in service of the cause, his nerves shredded and his bravery gone. He'd become erratic and indecisive, and he was drinking too much. His decision to go home was no less than suicide, and worse, it would endanger everything they'd worked for. He'd be taken by the Iron Hand. They'd torture him, and he'd give them Mara's name and address. At the very least, his decision to return to his family would cost the Resistance its richest benefactor. She'd be forced to go into hiding, and her assets would be seized. Garrick couldn't risk that, so there'd be extra men at the rendezvous to seize Keel and keep him safe, in chains if necessary, until his departure was no longer a threat. He wouldn't be going home tomorrow, or any time soon. Garrick had made Wilhelm swear that Keel wouldn't be harmed, although he wasn't sure how long his word would hold. Wilhelm liked the surety of death's silence a little too much. But Keel had backed them into this corner, and there was more at stake here than one man's feelings for his family. He'd never understood the need for sacrifice, not like Garrick did. "You remember old Crackjaw?" Keel said, rousing him from his thoughts. Garrick frowned. A strange subject to bring up now, but perhaps this was the moment for reminiscing. It was the last time they'd see each other, after all.
"Course I remember," he said. "He was a monster whale. Bit Rallon's launch clean in two and crunched him down. Terrorized the cut for a year."
"Remember the day we saw him?"
"Aye, I remember that too."
Garrick was only half listening, more concerned with keeping an eye out for soldiers. They could walk right into a patrol in these tight, high-walled lanes.
"There was a storm coming in fast," Keel said. "The waves were already climbing when Jad sighted him. There he was, some way off to starboard. The torn fluke, the markings on his flank, the size of him."
Keel's words conjured the memory, and a faint smile touched his lips.
"That was old Crackjaw, no doubt," said Garrick. "Right till that moment we were going to head for port, but you turned us into the storm instead." "God spit, I was a madman back then," said Keel. "I hungered for Sala's embrace. Went up against the worst the sea could throw at me. Anything to feel free. Anything rather than going home." "We all knew it too," said Garrick, warming to the tale. "Only the wildest sailed with you. We were all reckless, scornful of living.
There was kinship in that. The storm came upon us, howling like the thwarted dead. Keel had a fierce grin on his face. Rain like needles of ice, thunder fit to burst your ears. And we saw old Crackjaw again, and again after that, always before us, always just out of reach, like he was leading us into the heart of the tempest.
Keb went over, taken by a wave,
said Garrick, excited now, caught up in the memory.
The boat heeled and tipped till we weren't sure she'd stay afloat. We couldn't have dropped a launch if we tried, but we didn't care. You had us stand ready to harpoon that monster from the gunwales. You said it was only a matter of time before it turned and came at us.
He stopped then, and the fire in him waned.
But then you changed your mind. You told us to turn around, give up the chase and return to port with our lives. So we did, and old Crackjaw swam on, and this tale comes to nothing.
Keel drew back suddenly, holding up a hand. He peered round a corner, then motioned for Garrick to come and see. In the lane beyond, some way distant, four Croden soldiers loitered, talking quietly among themselves. Garrick cursed under his breath. Wilhelm had only a narrow window of opportunity, and they'd agreed to be there shortly after seventh bell. The patrol was blocking their route to the vintner's yard and showed no sign of moving. Keel pulled his shoulder and pointed at the mouth of an alleyway a little further up the hill.
"Reckon we can go around them that way."
Garrick grunted in agreement. With a last glance at the soldiers, they slipped into the alley and found themselves on a winding path between high-walled gardens, so narrow they had to go single file.
"Not nothing," said Keel from behind him.
"What's not nothing?"
"You said my tale comes to nothing. It doesn't. We never caught Crackjaw, but we lived instead, and we forged many new tales together that would not have been told elsewise."
Garrick was having trouble seeing his point, and was beginning to find the conversation irritating. The sight of the Croden patrol had reminded him that there were more important things to do tonight than indulge in nostalgia.
"You know why I didn't turn us around that day?"
Keel asked. Garrick didn't care, but it seemed easier to hear him out.
"Tell me."
"Because it hit me all in a flash," Keel said. "We'd already lost Keb. I thought of Halga's sons and Caffey's wife and all the men on that ship. Thought of you, too."
"You didn't all deserve to die just because I wanted to. I was ready to take you all down with me just to get that whale."
His voice became hard.
"The cause wasn't worth the cost. Reckon that's a lesson you never learned."
Garrick's mood darkened. So that's what this was about. One last argument before they were done.
"I'd see every man, woman and child in this land dead before I'd see them live as slaves," he growled, "and I'll give my life to stop it happening. Freedom has no price."
The alleyway came to a crossroads ahead. Garrick guessed that a right turn would bring them back to their path with only a little delay.
"Every man, woman and child might disagree with you," said Keel. "Is it really their freedom you're after? Or is it atonement? Still making amends for that day 30 years past when you failed in your duty? You say you're doing this for Ossia, Garrick, but maybe you were just doing it for you all along."
Garrick quelled a surge of anger. They were only words. Let the coward talk. He'd not be moralizing when Willem's men got hold of him.
"Some things are worth any cost," he said as he reached the junction.
"Not to me," said Keel, and he pulled Garrick's sword from its sheath with a ring of steel. Too late, Garrick saw the armoured men hidden to either side of the junction. They lunged, seizing his arms, driving him against the wall and cracking his head against the bricks hard enough to split the skin. He roared in rage and disbelief, kicked away from the wall to dislodge them, but now the gates of the surrounding gardens burst open, and iron guardsmen flooded out, swords at the ready.
"No!"
he shouted, in wild denial, as the reality of Keel's betrayal set in.
"No! No! No!"
He thrashed in their grip, but there were too many hands on him, and his dagger was pulled from his belt. Through the blood that ran into his eyes, he caught a glimpse of Keel beyond the melee. He was backing down the alley, Garrick's sword in his hand,
an expression on his face like a little boy aghast at a prank gone wrong.
"Kiel!"
he screamed, spittle flying.
"You son of a whore! Traitor! Traitor!"
Stars exploded behind his eyes as someone smashed the pommel of a dagger hard on his crown. His legs turned to water, and the soldiers bore him to the ground. Someone knelt on his neck, and his arms were wrenched up behind him. Before he could struggle free, there was a click of manacles, and a soldier booted him in the belly, hard enough to drive the wind from him. When his attackers drew back, they left him gasping on the floor like a fish. The blow to his head had him seeing double, and the man who approached him was little more than a dizzy blur. As he neared, the two images slowly merged. He was small and balding, with weak eyes and a wide, wet mouth, wearing the black coat of the Iron Hand. He hunkered down before Garrick. A soldier yanked his head up by the hair. "Cadrach of Darkwater," he said. "My name is Overwatchman Clisson. I've been looking forward to meeting you for some time." 80. Most nights, Fenn dreamed of falling, and tonight was no exception. She jerked awake in bed, heart lurching in her chest. Panic gave way to sweet relief as she found herself in a guest bedroom in Mara's house, in a bed softer than she'd ever slept in before. She lay there a moment, breathing hard, her head thick with wine, and a faint ache in her knees and shins, more remembered than real. There were urgent voices downstairs, men's voices, doors banging, hurrying feet. She sprang up, pulling on her clothes, a new panic driving her. Someone was barking orders below, the words muffled through the floor. "They found us." She snatched up her bow and arrows, her only thought to escape. Someone ran past in the corridor outside. Not that way, then. The window. She struggled with the catch, pushed it wide and leaned out. It wasn't a long drop to the garden. She'd be over the back wall before anyone could stop her. Go. Run. Survive. She hesitated with one foot up on the sill. Aaron and Cade were still in the house, and if the Crodans hadn't found her yet, maybe they hadn't found them either. The need to flee was an almost physical pull. She heard her father's voice. "Don't lean on anyone or anything, Fenn. Not no place or person. Elsewise, when they fall, you'll fall with them." She had to cut them all loose. She should have done it a long time ago, but Aaron and Cade held her back. They were the first people near her own age she'd ever grown close to. There had been others at Salt Fork, like Otten and Dox, but they hadn't liked her and she hadn't liked them. Aaron and Cade were her friends, perhaps the first real friends she'd ever had. Beyond the window was a wide, wild world, empty and frightening. Beyond the window, she'd be alone. She didn't want to go back to that. With an exasperated curse, she climbed down and darted to the door. She heard nobody nearby, only a clamour of rough voices below. Cracking the door open, she peeped out. The lamp-lit corridor was deserted. She could make it to their bedrooms if she was quick. Maybe they hadn't woken yet. They'd all been drunk, after all. She opened the door and hurried down the corridor, an arrow knocked to her bow, heart thumping. A short way along, she reached a landing overlooking the foyer. She pressed herself to the wall and peered down. The front door was wide open, letting in the night air. Movement below. She sucked in her breath as a man in a cowled cloak strode into view from another room. Fright made her draw and aim. If he should look up, if he should see her. "Fenn, no!" Aaron's voice made her start, and she almost let fly. The man below whirled, showing a black-bearded face she didn't know. "They're with us," said Aaron, stepping onto the landing from the other direction. "Listen." Fenn lowered her bow. Of course, they were speaking Ossian. She'd been frightened, muddled with sleep, and their voices had been muffled by the floor, but still, she should have realized. The two languages sounded nothing alike. The man she'd almost shot gave her a baleful glare, then hurried on. "What's happening?" Fenn asked. "I don't know," Aaron said as he reached her, "but I think we have to leave. Go wake Cade and Grub and Vika.
I'll find out what I can. Meet me in the parlour. That's where they've gathered, by the sound of it.
Cade was bleary and slow to rouse, though his eyes lit up when he saw Fenn at his bedside, at least until he heard why she'd come. Vika was already heading out by the time they got there, Ruck at her heel. Together they went to Grubb's room and found it empty. It was only when they called his name that he emerged from behind the door, holding up two daggers with an apologetic look on his face. The parlour was crowded with strangers, the atmosphere tense. Fenn pushed inside to join Aaron. Mara was in the centre of the room, deep in conversation with a small baby-faced man with hair a fierce shade of ginger. He was pacing angrily back and forth.
"That's Wilhelm the Smiler," Aaron told her, though he wasn't smiling now. "He's the leader of the rebels in Morgenholm. Garrick and Kiel were supposed to meet them, but they didn't show up. Wilhelm smuggled the cart in without them and then came here."
"Why smuggle it in without Garrick?" asked Fenn.
"They only had one chance to get it inside," said Aaron. "Garrick might be able to slip in later. Easier to sneak in one man than a whole cart."
"So it's sitting in the yard with a secret compartment and no one inside it? What happened to Garrick and Kiel?"
"Wilhelm's men are trying to find out, tapping all their contacts in the area. We know they were dropped off by Clear, and they didn't have far to go after that."
"If they don't find them soon, we have to leave," Cade interjected. He'd squeezed through the crowd to join them, along with Grubb.
"If they were captured..."
"Garrick would never talk," Aaron said firmly.
"Reckon Kiel would, though. Ain't like he's at the peak of mental stability these days, is it? Feller looks like he'd have a breakdown if you slammed the door too loud."
"We ought to go now," said Fenn.
She was feeling edgy, and this uncertainty troubled her.
"Freckles say something smart for once," said Grubb. "Hollow man gone, bitter bracker too. Croden's on the way, Grubb thinks."
"They might have been delayed," said Aaron, with forced optimism. "Chased off by a patrol. Maybe they're lying low till it's safe."
Grubb snorted skeptically. "And maybe Grubb have the gateway to a magic kingdom hidden in the crack of his arse."
There was a commotion at the door of the parlour, and a young man elbowed his way in, cheeks flushed.
"Wilhelm, I have news."
They crowded in closer to listen as he spoke with Wilhelm and Mara. Only Ruck was disinterested, occupied as she was with sniffing everyone in the room.
"We found someone who saw it all from their window," he panted. "The Iron Hand were waiting in ambush, and they've taken Garrick."
A murmur of shock went round the room. Aaron blanched. The man held up a sword.
"We found this nearby."
Mara inspected it. "It is his," she said at length, her voice dull.
"And Kiel?" Wilhelm asked.
"They let him go. It seems he was in league with the enemy."
There was uproar at that. Fenn felt as if she hadn't quite woken from her dream of falling. Garrick had given her direction when she had none. Even after the rout at Salt Fork, he'd made her believe. Now he was gone, betrayed by his own, and his grand plan lay in ruins.
"When they fall, you fall with them."
Vika looked stricken.
"He is taken?" she said in disbelief.
"This house is no longer safe," Wilhelm shouted over the hubbub, silencing them all. "Gather the guests, take them to the safe house in Riverside. Go in small groups and use different routes. Mara, you have carriages?"
"Two. Clear can drive one. The servants must come too. I'll not leave them to the Iron Hand."
"Well enough. The rest go by horse."
Wilhelm's soft face was screwed up in anger as he addressed the room.
"Gather anything the enemy could use against us. Burn what you can't take. Leave no trace. Move!"
81. The mood was bleak as the carriage jolted and bounced through city streets. They were packed in close, Aaron, Cade, Fenn, Vika and Grubb, with Ruck at their feet. Passing street lamps showed glimpses of drawn faces. Nobody spoke. Even Cade had the sense not to attempt one of his uplifting monologues. Aaron looked at the floor and despaired. How could it have turned so fast? How could it be over when it had just been about to begin? Garrick was gone, betrayed by his closest friend for the second time in his life, and with him went all hope of seizing the Ember Blade.
Aaron picked through the rubble of the night, looking for hope and finding none. There was no telling how much Kiel had revealed to the Iron Hand. They couldn't even send someone in Garrick's place. The whole plan was compromised. Were they already strapping Garrick into a chair in some torture chamber? Would his 30 years of struggle be rewarded with agony and death? For Kiel, whom he'd once thought a good man, he felt only black loathing. No wonder Clisson had been willing to let Aaron go. He knew he had a second traitor in his ranks if the first one failed. Aaron had believed himself clever in escaping the Iron Hand, but the Overwatchman had another card up his sleeve the whole time. It made him sick to think of how effortlessly he'd been outplayed. How could Kiel have done that to Garrick? How? But then Aaron knew how. He'd been a hair's breadth from doing it himself. "I thought," Vika began and then stopped. There was desolation on her face. "He was the champion, the one to seize the burning blade." Ruck folded her ears down and whined as Vika shook her head in disbelief. "Were the torments ever talking to me at all? Or was I talking to myself all along?"
"Grub talks to himself sometimes," the skull offered helpfully.
"Oh, shut up!" Cade snapped. Aaron sat in a window nook in an empty room, his knees drawn up to his chin, hugging himself. There was no lamp or lantern here, no rugs or hangings, nothing but a stack of battered mattresses in the corner. He was on the top floor of a tall old house, high above the street. Beyond the window was the river where Sovereign's Isle glittered in the night, as did the lights of the south bank beyond. He gazed through the glass, seeing nothing, in a state of perfect misery. There were voices below, Mara and Wilhelm arguing. Wilhelm's people thumped up and down the stairs, banging doors and holding urgent conversations. Garrick's capture had stirred them up like an ant's nest. Aaron and the others were ignored in the chaos, so Aaron had slipped away, hoping to clear his head. Alone at last, he'd stilled the clamour in his mind. But in its place he found a void, a numb vacancy of thought. Garrick was gone. The Ember Blade was gone. Even his father was gone. It was as if he'd died all over again last night. Doggedness was a part of Aaron's nature, but he'd been knocked down one time too many. This time, he felt like staying there, because what was the point of getting up again? He heard the door squeak open, casting a lopsided oblong of lamplight across the floorboards from the corridor. By the shadow it contained, he knew it was Fenn. She came in, closed the door, and sat at the foot of the windowsill, her back to the wall beneath him. "What are they saying?" he asked. "Some talk of staging a rescue," Fenn said. "Wilhelm won't allow it. We don't have the numbers to storm the Iron Hand headquarters, even if we could be sure he was there. Others want to hunt down Kiel to find out what he told them and make an example of him. Mara frets about the girls in the class she can no longer teach, and the servants she can no longer protect." "And the Ember Blade?" She shrugged. "No one's mentioned it. It was Garrick's plan, not theirs." Aaron felt nothing. Her words tumbled into the space inside him and were swallowed. For a long time, there was silence. "You probably noticed I'm afraid of heights," Fenn said at last. "I noticed. I never told you why." He waited. He had the sense that she was gathering herself. "After Ma died," she began, "my Da was different. You never saw any two people who loved each other more. Losing her broke him, and there was never joy in him again. The day we buried her, he told me I had to learn to look after myself. He'd take me out into the forest and up into the mountains, and leave me to find my way home. I had to survive on my own for days at a time. I was 11 or 12, I don't know. It went on for a few years. Once I got sick out there and nearly died. Once I was almost caught by a bear." Her tone stirred Aaron from his despair. Fenn had never spoken so openly before. It was like that night in the sanctum in Skavengard, waiting for the beast.
In her darkest moments, she reached out. "Don't lean on anyone or anything, Fen. Not no place or person. That's what he used to say. Elsewise, when they fall, you'll fall with them." He really meant himself. "Don't lean on me, because I don't plan to stay." But I never heard what he was saying. After Ma was gone, he was the only person I knew. All the tasks he set me, I did only to please him. I lived for the times when we'd do things together. "He was your father," said Aaron. "You just wanted to be with him. I know how that feels." One day, we headed out east towards the mountains. Where the land steepened, he chose hard routes and we had to climb. He went ahead of me each time, and at the top, he'd reach down to help me up. Twice he did that. The second time, I saw the disappointment in his eyes, the grief, but I didn't see it for what it was. I had no idea. Her voice wobbled. She might have been crying or trying to stop herself. Aaron couldn't see her face. She was sitting below him with her back to the wall. Without thinking, he let his hand dangle down next to her. She reached up and took it just as absently, her fingers folding around his, gripping tight. "The third time," she said, her voice dull with remembered pain. "The third time he dropped me. He did it on purpose to show me. Sometimes we're so casual about putting our lives in each other's hands, and he wanted to show me the danger. So he let go." Her grip tightened on his hand, and he knew she was falling again, that she'd always be falling. "I broke both legs," she said. "Lay there, screaming. I thought it was an accident, expected him to save me. But he never came. So after a while I stopped screaming because there was no point. I'd only attract wolves and bears." "How did you survive?" Aaron asked quietly. "I crawled home." "I crawled home." Aaron couldn't imagine the agony contained in those three short words. The pain of dragging two shattered legs behind her for hours, for days perhaps. The kind of pain that made it easier to lie down and die. All the while knowing that her father had dropped her on purpose, and that she had no choice but to go back to him. Where had she found the strength to carry on? "He was there when I got home," she said. "Drunk, but not so much that he couldn't put me on a cart and take me to town. The healer set my legs so they wouldn't mend crooked, and I had to rest at home for a long time. A long time. My father fed me. He owed me that, I suppose. But I never spoke another word to him in his life." She sniffed. So she was crying then. He imagined the tears he couldn't see, and his chest tightened. His feelings of betrayal towards his father must have been nothing compared to hers. Yet still she hadn't given up. Still she'd kept on going, until one day her path crossed his. That thought shamed him. What right had he to wallow in misery when she had a greater claim to it? "What happened to him?" he asked. "He stayed till I was fit again, able to walk and hunt. Then one morning he walked out into the forest with no pack, no supplies and no weapons. He never came back. I never looked for him." She wiped her cheeks with her free hand. Her voice was steady now. "He'd wanted to end himself ever since Ma died, but he couldn't go till he knew I would survive on my own. In his way, I think he tried to make it easy for me, so it wouldn't hurt so much when he was gone. He did the best he could." Aaron stared out at the city, a heavy weight on his heart. No longer was he numb. It was impossible not to feel with her hand in his. He wondered how much cruelty the world could hold. How many other stories like hers were out there, hidden behind darkened windows, kept secret by doors and walls. How many men who beat their wives near to death, how many starving and neglected children, how many who planned treachery against those they professed to love. Weighed against that, his own despair seemed a small thing. He had life, strength, and liberty. If his dreams had come tumbling down, well, at least he'd been allowed them in the first place.
He found himself becoming furious. How could Fenn's father give up on his child like that? Perhaps he thought it an act of love to delay his suicide, but to Aaron's mind it was cowardice. He'd always intended to abandon her, and had only instilled that lonely philosophy so he could die with a clear conscience and avoid the harder road of carrying on. Now she'd been let down again. She'd put her faith in Garrick and his cause, and Garrick was gone, betrayed. Just when she was learning to trust others, her father's ghost had returned. He didn't think she'd trust again after this. His despair felt false and indulgent now. He was angry, and he turned that to strength. He wasn't giving up today, and nor was anyone else. "Come on," he said, pulling her up. "On your feet." He swung his legs off the sill and dropped to the floor. "Where are you going?" She sighed wearily. Her eyes and nose were red, but they were dry. "It's done, Aaron. Garrick was the one with the plan." "Then we make a new plan," Aaron said. "We still have Yarin's notes, don't we? And we still have time till the wedding. Garrick saved my life more than once, and I'm damned if I'll count him lost just because the Iron Hand have him. Damned if I'll give up this chance to take back the Ember Blade." He put his hand on her arm and held her gaze, so she could see he was in earnest. "And I'm damned if I'll let you think your father was right. There are people in this world you can believe in, Fenn. You can believe in me." He burst through the door, carried on a wave of new conviction, and as he stormed downstairs, he found courage in his certainty. Consequences meant nothing in his mind. He'd do anything rather than passively accept his fate. "Aaron?" It was Cade, coming up the staircase from the first floor with Grubb behind him. Aaron swept past, too focused on his purpose to stop. Cade and Grubb exchanged a glance and followed him.
"Mad's like mad about something," Grubb said with a grin as Fenn caught them up.
The safe house was chilly and sparsely furnished, all bare boards and stone. It was a temporary place for people passing through. The largest room was the basement, where a plain wooden table was scattered with jacks of ale and heels of bread. A dozen men and women sat around it by lantern light, more standing against the walls. Vika was among them, leaning dejectedly on her staff, Ruck at her feet. Orica and Harrod were there too. She looked worried, while he showed nothing at all. Mara and Wilhelm, both seated, were arguing as Aaron came in. "At least send someone to the Vintner's Yard to take Garrick's place," Mara said. "If Kiel had told the Iron Hand about the cart, the ambush would have been at your rendezvous, and they'd have arrested you too. Whatever his reasons, the evidence suggests he was careful to betray no one but Garrick. The risk is worth taking to get somebody inside Hammerholt."
"And who'd go?" Wilhelm asked, with a smile that was more of a sneer. "None of my people."
"Garrick knows little of our operations in Morganholm, but even a little is too much. I will not send someone who could supply the Crodans with the rest of it. No. We cut our losses and retreat. There will be other chances to strike at the Crodans."
"But not like this. Never again like this." There was desperation in Mara's voice.
"I will not retreat," said Aaron as he walked into the room. "Nor will I leave Garrick to the Iron Hand. 30 years ago, the people of this land refused to fight because they were too afraid of losing what they had. We must not make that mistake again. This is our best, perhaps our only chance, to knock our overlords from their pedestals."
He swept the room with his gaze, meeting scornful amazement with defiance. Most looked amused. They saw only a self-important boy with a surfeit of opinion. But he was their equal, and he stood his ground. "Do any of you even know who Garrick is, this man you're so eager to abandon?" he demanded.
"A man who should choose his friends more carefully," somebody quipped, to general laughter.
"He is Cadrach of Darkwater," Aaron shouted over their mirth. "He is the last Dawn Warden, the only living guardian of the Ember Blade. That is who you would cast aside."
Vika cried out in anguish, and it was her reaction more than his words that sobered the room. But while the others were shocked, Aaron saw Wilhelm's grin turn angry, and he realized that Wilhelm had known.
Murmurs ran around the room, and he saw doubt on some faces. Aaron was loath to reveal another man's secrets, but he hadn't been sworn to silence, and he couldn't think of another way to save Garrick. Secrets had got them into this mess. It was time for a little honesty.
"Is it true?" one of Wilhelm's men asked.
"Ask him," Aaron pointed at Wilhelm, whose smile was now a rictus of hate.
"Wilhelm?" said a woman at the table. "You knew?"
"I didn't know for sure," Wilhelm told them, but he wasn't firm enough to be convincing. "I heard tell the Crodans were hunting the last Dawnwarden, and that he'd been at Salt Fork, but I didn't pry further. If Garrick had wanted us to know, he'd have told us."
"If he's a Dawnwarden, we must save him," said a man at the back of the room, and there was a chorus of agreement around him.
"No," said Wilhelm, surging to his feet and slamming his hand down on the table. "Do you think the Crodans would take a Dawnwarden to some shabby local jail with drunken guards we could bribe or overpower? He's a great prize for the Empire. Likely he is halfway to Hammerholt by now, where he will languish in the most secure dungeon they have until such time as they decide to execute him. Would you dash yourselves against the walls of that fortress to get him back?"
"I would," said Aaron. His mind was racing, but his voice was calm. "Mara, you have Yarin's plans. You said there was an Erd structure underneath Hammerholt, and waterways that lead from the lake. Can you find us a way in?"
"If there is a way inside, I will find it," said Mara.
"And if there is none, we will enter by the front gate. There will be hundreds of people going into and out of that fortress every day. There must be a way to smuggle ourselves in, and not just one of us this time, all of us."
He was excited, and saw an answering excitement in his friends. He might not know how they'd do it yet, but he knew they could, and the others were beginning to believe too. But Wilhelm laughed in contempt.
"Brave words and heroic fantasies. This is life and death, not some game of knights with wooden swords. Leave the thinking to the adults, boy."
"And who are you to me?" Aaron replied with equal contempt, killing the smirks on the faces of their audience. "Where were you when we defeated the Beast of Skavengard? Where were you when we faced Crodan Dreadknights, not once but three times? Were you hiding away then as now? You're not one of us. If you don't want to help, stand aside."
What remained of the mirth in the room was gone, replaced by cold silence and a touch of fear. No one spoke to Wilhelm the Smiler that way.
Wilhelm's smile turned murderous.
"You've quite the mouth on you, whelp," he said.
There was a ring of steel as he pulled his dagger from its sheath.
"You need to learn some manners."
Aaron's courage faltered at the sight of the blade. Swept up in his own enthusiasm, he'd misjudged the danger, failed to see the killer's heart inside this baby-faced man. And here in Wilhelm's safe house, surrounded by his people, the only law that applied was his. Perhaps Wilhelm meant to cut his throat, or take an ear, or merely give him a scar on his cheek for his impertinence. Aaron never found out. Wilhelm lunged forward, his blade flickering in the lamplight, and his arm was caught by a strong hand around the wrist.
"I think not," said Harrod, towering over the smaller man. "As the young master says, you are not one of us."
Wilhelm's eyes blazed and his cheeks flamed red, but Harrod was immovable, projecting such fearless strength that it was impossible not to be intimidated. Wilhelm looked around, expecting someone to come to his aid, but not even his own people wanted to see a young man hurt for the crime of being passionate. He'd lost the room in his rage, and he saw it. He snarled and pulled free with a curse, throwing his dagger point down into the table.
"Look at them," Aaron thought. "Look how the mere mention of a Dawnwarden inspires them. What, then, could the Ember Blade do?"
Wilhelm's men were torn between fear of their leader and their desire to go to a Dawnwarden's aid. Aaron believed some of them would join him if he asked, but that would be a direct challenge to Wilhelm, and he'd pushed far enough.
"Wilhelm," he said, holding up his hands, "I spoke hastily and I apologize. Fear leads to careless words, and I am scared for my friend. You are right to be cautious, and I know there is much at stake,
I do not ask you to risk your people, only that you do not hinder us, and perhaps you'll be gracious enough to render us what aid you safely can. We are all on the same side." Furious as Willem was, he was canny enough to see the way out Aaron offered him, which would allow him to retreat with his pride mostly intact. "Would that Kiel was as loyal to Garrick as the rest of you," he said. He glowered at their audience, reasserting his authority over them. "Be about it, then. It's foolishness, but your lives are your own. We will give you what help we are able, but we will not go to Hammerholt with you, for you go to your deaths." "So be it," said Aaron. "You have our thanks." Willem pulled the dagger from the table, staring at Harrod as he sheathed it again. Then he walked from the room, and his people followed him uneasily, leaving only Aaron and his companions behind.
"Ha! Madslug showed Carrot Top who's boss," Grubb crowed.
"I don't know if I just made an ally or an enemy," Aaron said. The tension of the confrontation was leaving him, and he was light-headed with victory. "Thank you, Harrod. It would have gone the worse for me if you had not been here."
The knight merely nodded.
"You spoke well," said Vicar, stepping forward. "And Dawn Warden or not, Garrick deserves more from us than to be abandoned, whatever the odds."
Ruck barked in agreement.
"I will not abandon him either," said Mara, as she rose to stand with the others. "There is still hope." Cade spoke up next. "You're sure he really is a Dawn Warden?" he said in awe. "I'm sure," said Aaron. "Then count me in." "We are with you," said Orica, speaking for Harrod too, as she laid a hand on his arm.
"Hammerholt is impenetrable fortress, heavily guarded, very dangerous?"
Grubb rubbed his hands together.
"Good. Grubb needs new tattoos."
Aaron looked last to Fen. She smiled at him and dipped her head in a nod, and the look she gave him kindled a hot glow in his chest.
"There is one matter outstanding," Mara said. "What shall be done about Kiel?"
Aaron's mood spoiled at the thought of the bitter bracker. He mastered himself before he could let bitterness take control. There were greater things at stake.
"Vengeance is not our business here," he said. "Kiel will be gone with the tide and can harm us no further. Even if we could find him in time, punishing him would serve no purpose."
"Grubb punish him for fun?" the Skarl volunteered, raising a dagger.
"Aye," snarled Cade. "We agree on something for once."
"No," Vika said. "Our time is short. We cannot waste it on pointless retribution."
"He is not worth the hunt," Fen said. "If we want him, we know where he'll be."
"I concur," said Mara. "If we are to save Garrick and retrieve the Ember Blade, we must work with all speed and work together. Are we all committed to this course?"
"Aye,"
they shouted in response, and even Harrod, nodding grimly, had a new glint of fire in his eye. 82. Kiel sat swollen-eyed, watching through a narrow window as morning stole over the docks. Two empty bottles stood on the table before him, and he'd nearly finished a third. It had been a long and lonely watch by candlelight, here in the poky garret of a tumble-down inn. Many shadowed hours had dragged by, with only his liquor for company, his thoughts circling like sharks round a kill. But soon it would be over. Soon. The room was bare and draughty, holding little more than a table, a chair, and a mean bed. Chill air seeped down from the rafters. Kiel relished that small suffering. He didn't deserve comfort or joy or love ever again. The inn had a good view of the waterfront, where drunken sailors on their way back to their hammocks weaved between stevedores loading cargo. Among the forest of masts was the ship he was due to leave on, a fast clipper called the Merryweather, headed for Rackham Bay and other towns up the cut. He'd met the captain and paid for a berth yesterday in anticipation of a swift departure.
He wouldn't survive long in Morgenholm once news of his betrayal spread. Wilhelm the Smiler would see to that. He swilled his liquor, welcoming the burn in his throat and belly. Blearily he saw that the Merryweather was moving now, slipping away from the jetty, out into the quay. He watched it head downriver, Sovereign's Isle rising steep and green in the background. When it passed beyond his sight, he let out a sob, surprising himself. He hadn't known there were tears on his cheeks. He wasn't going home. He was never going home. His eyes fell to the document beside the empty bottles. He couldn't read Croden in his current state. Even reading it sober was like wading through mud. But he knew what it said. It was a promise. A lifetime income for Mariella and Tad. A grant of ownership to Fluke's farm. A pardon for his crimes. And most importantly of all, an instruction to Lord Jadril to secure the best medical attention for Tad, with all costs paid by the Empire. Drunken tears spilled afresh. My boy. You'll live, my boy. You'll live to see wonders, just like you did at the Marisport Fair. I promised you that. Secured to the foot of the document was a small silver disc, imprinted with a complex pattern around its edge, and the double-barred cross in the centre. It was the work of a master craftsman, highly valuable and almost impossible to duplicate. The seal of the Iron Hand. No one would argue with a message that came with that seal attached. Next to it was the tight, neat signature of Overwatchman Clisson, the bespectacled demon who'd forged this contract. He'd met Clisson in the headquarters of the Iron Hand after they'd caught him outside the Burned Bear. If Clisson had made threats, if he'd urged him to give up the others as well, Kiel would have dug his heels in. But somehow Clisson knew that. Instead, his proposal was as simple as it was cruel. Garrick's life for Tad's. And God spit, it wasn't as if Garrick had long to go anyway. Even before they'd talked in the barn, Kiel had known Garrick was headed for destruction. His plan was half-formed, making no provision for escape, and his obsession with ending the Croden occupation bordered on madness. Everyone was expendable in service of his quest, and it had already claimed many lives. He was hurtling eagerly towards his end. Yet even after Kiel had made his deal, he'd held on to a last shred of faith. He'd gone to find Garrick, still wanting to be persuaded, to be shown the wisdom of his path, looking for a reason not to betray him. The truth, when it emerged, was worse than he'd imagined. Barrels full of Ellerite oil. A plan to murder Prince Otico and the entire Croden High Command in Ossia. Garrick wasn't just seeking death, but war as well. And if he succeeded, he'd plunge them into a brutal state of occupation, which Mariella and Tad would surely not survive. But what hurt the most, what cut deepest of all, was that he'd decided to do it without Kiel. He folded up the document, took a stick of wax, and held it unsteadily in the candle flame. He made a clumsy seal and pressed it with his thumb as a makeshift mark, then turned it over and wrote an address on the blank side, one eye closed as he carefully scratched the letters. That done, he pushed it away, sat back, and took a bitter swig from his bottle. Garrick had cut him out. That was the crux of it. If he hadn't, perhaps Kiel wouldn't have betrayed him. But Garrick had grown remote and secretive, careless of Kiel's concerns. He dismissed Kiel's dilemma over his family as if Mariella was a nuisance and Tad was worth nothing. Fluke's death lay at his door, but he barely acknowledged it, let alone admitted his responsibility. Kiel felt betrayed, so he'd betrayed Garrick in return. For his family. For the good of Ossia. He felt a wrench in his guts, and sucked down another swallow of liquor to quell it. He wanted to kill all thought, but the thoughts kept coming, swarming up towards him like black tentacles reaching from the dark and waiting behind the mouths within... He started back to reality with a jerk, gasping. He took another hit from the bottle. It didn't work. Nothing worked. A knock at the door made him jump again.
heart bumping against his ribs. He stared at it, fearfully. Willem's men, already? Garrick himself, escaped and returned for vengeance?
"Imperial courier," came the voice from beyond the door.
His muscles unclenched. In his drunken haze, he'd forgotten he'd sent for a courier.
"Come in."
The door creaked open, and a clean-cut young Croden peered through, dressed in a neat uniform. He looked around the small, miserable room, clearly wondering if he'd come to the wrong place.
"You have a message?" he asked.
Keel tapped the document on the table.
"Imperial Post, eh?"
"Of course," said the courier as he approached. "It will be delivered by hand. There is no way more sure or secure, short of delivering it yourself."
"That won't be happening," Keel slurred.
He took out a pouch of money and emptied it onto the table. It was all the money he had left in the world. The courier raised an eyebrow.
"That's far too much." "It's yours," said Keel. "But listen close. I want you to open it and read it to her. She doesn't have letters." Don't put it in her hands without reading it to her first. Understand? It's life and death. She'll destroy it."
"You may rest assured," said the courier. "It will be as you ask." He picked up the letter and read Keel's drunken handwriting with some difficulty. "Mariella from Ariane of Rackan Bay. Do I have it right?"
"You do."
The courier scooped the money off the table into his pouch, straightened, and gave Keel a look of concern.
"Your pardon, but are you well? Is there someone I can fetch for you?" "I'll be fetched soon enough," said Keel. "Go on." "As you wish.
Hail to the Emperor," said the courier. He saluted and left.
So it is done, thought Keel.
He'd finally made his choice. Garrick had always called him indecisive, but how was a man to decide when all choices left him wretched? Stay in Rackan Bay in misery, or abandon your family for adventure? Die in pain on a Croden rack with your family condemned to starve, or save your loved ones at the expense of your only true friend? He was neither the husband he should be, nor the man he aspired to be. He was a failure and a traitor, and now he could never go home. Everyone would know he was a collaborator, including Mariella and Tad. To return would be to trap himself into the life he'd so desperately wanted to escape, despised by all those he'd once called friends. Every coin that came to his family would be stained with Garrick's blood. Mariella deserved more than him in a husband. Tad deserved more in a father. Could he have chosen a different path in the end? Was there any right way? Or did all routes lead here to this meagre garret with no options left? No options but one. He walked over to the bed and picked up the rope that lay coiled there. Easy to find rope on the docks. He set to work, fashioning himself a noose. He was a whaler. He knew knots. It was a relief to be doing something honest again. When he was ready, he dragged his chair over beneath the thick rafter overhead. Mouths, slavering mouths, exhaling dread, and how they wanted him with such hideous, lustful need. He stumbled away with a cry, back towards the table where he drained the bottle. When he was done, he leaned there, panting, face drawn and shiny with sweat in the cold morning light from the window. No more. He was driven back to the noose by that thought. He could suffer no longer the horror of what he'd seen, what he'd done, what he'd become. The darkness that had always stalked him had returned and consumed him. He'd stayed ahead of it for a few years, on the road with Garrick, but it had never lost his trail. Now there was only cold emptiness, and there'd be no laughter again. That was a hell worth escaping at any price. Up on the chair he went, and tied the rope round the rafter, working with grim efficiency. When it was done, he put his head through and tightened the loop. No going back. He had not a coin to his name, nor a friend in the world.
The future held nothing but starvation or murder at the hands of Wilhelm's people. Only by shutting off all ways out could he take this way forward. He closed his eyes, silent tears of relief running down his face. It was so simple now. So simple. He kicked the chair and dropped. 83. "Are you all listening?" said Aaron. "This is the plan." Cade could hardly suppress his excitement. There were 9 of them round the table, in the light of a lantern hanging from a chain overhead. Before them were jacks of ale and leather goblets of wine. Their faces were shadowed and grave and full of purpose. They'd come to learn how they might do the impossible and write themselves into legend. The safe house basement had been transformed since Aaron's confrontation with Wilhelm. Now every wall was covered with nailed-up pieces of parchment showing diagrams, lists of dates, schedules, maps, and other things incomprehensible to a slow reader like Cade. On the table were several plans showing the various floors of Hammerholt. Mara and Aaron had spent the last 2 days in a frenzy of plotting, comparing staff rotors and consulting moon charts, wading through the mind-boggling complexities of a royal wedding. Neither had slept much, and it showed. But though Aaron looked drawn, there was a fierce conviction in his voice. "Wilhelm's people have learned that Garrick is to be executed at dawn on Scores Day, the day before the wedding," he said. He was leaning over the table, his hands spread across the floor plans. "General Dakin, who destroyed the Dawn Wardens 30 years ago, will wield the blade himself. They mean to tidy up the last loose end before the new era begins. The princess and her considerable retinue will arrive after the execution, which will cause chaos among the staff, so most guests have been instructed to arrive the day before, on Chain Day. Hundreds will be coming, and all of them will need to be fed, entertained, and accommodated. Even for such efficient organisers as the Crodans are, it will be pandemonium. That's when we will strike." He cast his gaze around the table. "If we are to triumph, we must be like the workings of a clock, everyone doing their part, acting in perfect harmony. We work as a team, or we fall together." He glanced briefly at Fenn. "Are we all of one mind in this?" "Tell us what must be done," said Vika, scratching behind Ruck's ear. She seemed recovered from her poisoned wound, but the need to rest had kept her from joining in the planning as much as she'd wanted. Aaron pushed away from the table and pointed to a faded and ancient-looking diagram on the wall that showed nothing Cade understood. "Hammerholt gets its water from Lake Calagria in the mountains nearby," he said. "It passes through a series of caves into a tunnel, probably built by the Erds in the First Empire." He returned to the table and stabbed the floor plans with a finger. "We think that this door in the sewers underneath Hammerholt opens into a cave at the end of that tunnel. A secret escape route, perhaps, or a way for engineers to access the caves in days gone by, when the lake was lower. It's possible the Crodans don't know about it. The fortress is vast, and most of it lies unused. Either way, a small boat can make it through the caves to that door. But there are 2 significant problems." Mara took over. "First of all, we can't open the door from the cave side, and it will certainly be too thick to break down."
"Grub can pick any lock," the Skull boasted.
"Well, there will likely be no lock at all, only a handle. According to my calculations, the cave is submerged when the lake is high. This door will have been built to withstand that, and I suspect it will be barred on the other side to prevent Hammerholt from flooding."
"So how will you open it?"
Wilhelm the Smiler asked. He'd insisted on joining them tonight to hear their plans. Since they were here on his sufferance, he wanted to know what they were up to, and they had little choice but to let him listen. "One of us will have to open it from the other side," Aaron said. "Only 5 of us will be in that boat, 6 if Ruck is coming." "She is," said Vika. Ruck put her paws up on the table and barked, as if offended at the possibility she might be left behind. "Do not fear. She can be stealthy when she needs to be." 6 then," said Aaron. He gave Ruck a tired smile. "Harrod, Orica, and Mara will get inside another way." Cade sat back in his chair, a jack of ale in his hand, marvelling. All his life,
Aaron had just been Aaron, strong-willed and full of plans, but still a small-town boy for all that, no more remarkable than Cade was. Now here stood a different Aaron, who spoke with clarity and command, and bore himself with a presence beyond his years. In Ossia, adulthood wasn't an age but an attitude. Their history was littered with child queens, young generals, and precocious scholars. Aaron was barely 16, but the last few months had made him a man worthy and willing to take the lead in Garrick's absence. They listened to him, though he was the youngest here. Cade grinned. He'd never been more proud to be Aaron's best friend. Earlier this afternoon, Wilhelm and his people located Morgenholm's most eminent lutist in an inn, said Aaron. He nodded at Wilhelm. He'd been careful to keep him sweet since their encounter. Cade would never have forgiven him so, but Aaron had a way of making enemies into allies. There was an unfortunate accident, Aaron went on. A passer-by gracelessly spilled her drink. Of course, being polite, he bought her another one, this time laced with one of Vika's potions. Grubb, who'd been squirming with glee in his seat, could no longer contain himself.
It was Grubb. Grubb did that.
Right now she is beginning to feel very ill indeed, said Vika solemnly. She'd painted her face again and wore all of her trinkets, including the effigy of Sala that Fenn had whittled for her. In the lantern light she was shaggy and feral and strange. There will be no lasting damage, but she will not stray far from a bucket for the next few days. The leader of the troop is desperate, said Aaron. They were due to perform at one of the many feasts in Hammerholt, but now their star musician cannot play. They will be forced to miss the wedding and the generous payment for their services. He held out a hand towards Orica. Luckily, he will soon cross paths with a wandering minstrel who happens to be prodigiously talented and familiar with all the songs they are likely to play.
You are very kind, Orica said with a smile.
I still say it is too dangerous, Harrod said. This city is unsafe for Sards.
Peace, Harrod, said Orica. We must all bear our share of the risk.
She will be under the troop's protection until the wedding is done, said Aaron. There will be honoured guests from across the near world in Hammerholt, so a Sard won't excite much notice, and they are not officially outlaws yet. The Crodans haven't even admitted they're rounding them up. They won't start trouble at a royal wedding. Cade found it hard to tell if Harrod was mollified or not. His face was rigid, but he said no more, so Aaron moved on. Once inside, Orica's job is to get away from the troop and go to the lower levels, which should be relatively empty. She will make her way to the sewer door and let us in.
And what if it is sealed shut, or needs a key, or she is seen and turned back? Wilhelm asked.
Mara met his gaze calmly. Then Orica will have to use her initiative. Additionally, if Harrod or I have completed our tasks, then we will also make our way to the door. It is vital enough to merit a certain level of redundancy.
Let us be very clear about the risks, said Aaron. The margins here are very narrow. The lake is tidal, and we will only be able to access the caves at the lowest tide. By the time we reach the door, the lake will be rising again, and our way out will be cut off. The cave will fill up. If Orica cannot get that door open in time, we will drown.
Cade felt the enthusiasm drain out of him. Suddenly the plan didn't sound so good.
I warned you, said Aaron, seeing his face fall. If one part fails, we all do. Those of you who don't want to be on that boat, speak now. No one will judge you.
Is there no other way? Fenn asked. Not if we want to smuggle in weapons and enough people to do what has to be done.
There was a grim silence around the table.
How long would I have? Said Orica.
Mara replied. The tides are complicated. Thea has two moons that follow irregular orbits and only repeat their cycle every 2.25 years. On top of that, it is necessary to calculate the volume of the water, correcting for any choke points which will slow the flow and the time it takes for... Her words became a jumble to Cade. Why did she need to explain so much? He wished Aaron would talk again. At least he was direct.
Given all that, Mara finished at last, I have calculated that we will have about an hour before we drown. Orica, you will need to open the door by first bell of dark, or last light, which fall together this time of year.
By fair means or foul, I will do it, said Orica.
Cade swallowed, thinking of the freezing water rising around them as they gasped for the last pockets of air. But his fright quickly faded. He found it hard to be afraid of something that hadn't happened yet, and the future didn't bother him overmuch, as a rule. It all felt beyond his control, so it wasn't worth worrying about. Let tonight be tonight, and tomorrow be tomorrow.
Harrod and I will enter through the front gate, said Mara. Harrod is a scion of High House Anselm of Harrow, and despite his disagreements with his family, his rank entitles him to an invitation to the wedding of a Harish princess. It was not easy to secure one at such short notice, but I do have certain connections.
It was hard not to notice the bitterness that crept into her voice, but Cade didn't understand it, and she didn't elaborate. Harrod was looking as uncomfortable as Cade had ever seen him. He clearly disliked trading off his family name after the disgrace he'd brought upon them. Cade wondered how many more unspoken sacrifices, how many quiet agonies he'd endured for Orica's sake.
Putting up with Grubb's abuse was an act of heroism in itself.
I will pose as Harrod's wife, said Mara. A half-smile twitched at the edge of her mouth. I'm a little old for the role, but there have been stranger matches.
Ha! Ballhead get married,
spluttered Grubb, spraying ale. Mara ignored him. We will join the other guests for the entertainments.
Grubb's face fell.
That about right, he grumbled. Bossy Chops and Ballhead get to watch jugglers and stuff their faces while we all drown.
No one is going to drown, said Aaron. Harrod and Mara will take care of Jarrett Ban, the Master of Keys. He alone can access the vault where the Ember Blade will be kept. He pointed again at the floor plans to show them. His name is not on the list for any feast, so we assume he will head to his chambers after the pre-dinner entertainments are over. This presents a problem, because that's likely to be where the key to the vault will be kept, and we need him not to be there.
Would he not keep such a key with him at all times? Orica asked.
Yarin's spies think otherwise, said Mara. He locks his most important keys in his study. It would be too easy for a thief to pilfer them if he carried them on his person.
Grubb could just kill him, Grubb suggested.
We are trying to do this without leaving bodies, Aaron said.
Grubb harrumphed and drank his ale.
Once we are in, some of us will head to the cells to free Garrick, but Grubb will go to the Master of Keys' office while Harrod and Mara delay him elsewhere. He will need time to search the place because, for all Yarin's comprehensive information, we know almost nothing about the vault door or how it is opened. Mara and Harrod will learn whatever they can from the Master of Keys.
Grubb will get you in, Mudslug, don't worry.
And no one will notice a skull running around the corridors of Hammerholt? Wilhelm asked sceptically. Or, for that matter, a druidess with a dog?
Cade flashed him a look of annoyance. His purpose here appeared to be to poke holes in Aaron's plan, and there were holes enough in it already.
Aaron didn't seem to mind. We thought of that, he said. Hammerholt is so big that whole areas are disused or have fallen into disrepair. Yarin has provided us with keys to those areas, so we can make our way around the celebrations rather than through them. As to Grubb, he will go in through the window.
Grubb climb up outside wall. Grubb better than anyone at climbing. One time, Grubb climb into a maiden's tower, and he...
What of Garrick? Said Vika. How will we free him?
Aaron traced a route through the plans with his finger and tapped on the dungeons. Those of us not working to secure the key to the vault will make our way to the cells, subdue the guard, and leave them in Garrick's place. There's usually only one man on duty, but we will have the numbers and the weapons to deal with more if we need to. The shift doesn't change over till sixth bell, by which time we will be long gone.
Maybe Orica can get away from the troop. Maybe she can open the door, said Wilhelm. Maybe the Skarl can steal the key to the vault. Maybe Mara and Harrod can keep the Master of Keys distracted.
Maybe there'll only be one guard. Maybe you won't be seen. He raised an eyebrow. There's a lot that could go wrong with your plan.
Or it may be easier than we think, Aaron replied. There's no way to know until we're inside.
Wilhelm shook his head with a despairing smile and sat back, arms crossed.
Once we have Garrick, Aaron went on, we head to the vault, where Grubb will meet us with the key. We will take the Ember Blade and return to the door in the sewers while the Crodans are busy feasting. By this time, according to Mara's calculations, the water will be falling again. We may have to hide a while before we can enter the cave again and take the boat back to the lake, but if all has gone to plan, the Crodans will have no idea anything is amiss until much later.
What if all does not go to plan? Asked Fenn. What if the alarm is raised, and we can't wait an hour or two to escape?
There is another way out, said Mara, but we do not want to go that way if we can help it.
An Erd underkeep lies beneath Hammerholt, said Aaron. It was built over when the original fortress was destroyed, but it's still down there, and we think the Crodans have broken through the foundations and begun exploring. We don't know why, and we have no maps of it. But it's reasonable to assume there are other exits down there, even if we don't know where they are.
There will be no light, and no telling what we might find, said Mara. I have studied Erd architecture and culture extensively, and read reports from delvers who have explored their ruins. The Erds were masters at constructing traps, some of which might still be operational after all this time. It would be far better to leave through the caves.
And after that, said Fenn, if we do manage to get away with the Ember Blade?
If luck is with us, the Crodans will never even know who stole it. If not, it may be necessary to disappear for a while. We will leave ourselves maps and supplies in case.
There was a moment of silence, and then Wilhelm clapped his hands, making Kay jump.
Excellent, he said brightly. I think you are mad, and you will all die, but it's audacious, I'll give you that.
A little audacity is what we need if we hope to free our country, said Aaron. Look where playing safe has got us.
Wilhelm shrugged to concede the point, then finished his drink and stood up. Regardless, I wish you the mummer's luck. If you can pull it off, they'll sing of you forever. Any who decide not to go, you'll be welcome to join my people instead. We need brave folk, and if you're even considering going along with this, well, then you really are brave.
The moment he was gone, Aaron turned to them, his eyes flashing with determination.
Did you hear that? He said. They will sing of us forever. That is what the Ember Blade means to our people. Yes, there is a risk, great risk, but it is worth the prize. I fear death, as do we all, but I would do this alone if I had to.
You will not go alone, said Vika. Ruk and I are with you. If there is still hope for the champion to seize the blade, we must not falter.
Grubb going too. No one singing any songs that don't have Grubb in them.
Cade couldn't keep down a grin. The Skull was obnoxious and annoying, but his reckless bravery was strangely inspiring.
Well, I certainly ain't staying behind with Smiler and his miserable lot.
Mara agreed too, and Harrod, and when it came to Orica, she smiled at them all, her face lighting up.
I know how my song ends now, she said. I hear it at last. I must find my lute and some paper to mark it down.
Hold, hold, said Mara. We are not finished.
She nodded at Fenn, who hadn't yet spoken. All eyes turned to her, and she looked fearful and hunted in the lantern light.
How easily you put your lives in one another's hands, she said quietly. Then she lowered her head.
But we must stand together, or we will fall alone. I will come.
Don't worry, Cade told her. We've done plenty of stupid stuff in the past, but Aaron's never got me killed yet.
Then we are agreed, said Aaron. We go to make history. We go to take back our destiny.
He lifted his jack high, sloshing ale over the rim.
For Garrick and the Ember Blade, he cried.
In their answering cheer, Cade heard the sound of victory, and his chest swelled with pride as he roared his approval.
Look at me now, Da.
Look at me now.
84. Oars creaked and water lapped against the rowing boat as it slid across the lake towards a broken wall of grey cliffs. The sun was golden on the mountains, and the air was crisp with the bite of coming winter. Grubb leaned forward and pulled again, and the boat drew on, the small sounds of its passage swallowed by the enormous, lonely quiet of the lake. Ruck sat at the prow like a figurehead, shaggy and straight-backed, tongue lolling in the wind. Vika hunkered beside her, patched furs and painted face, one hand on her hound. Aaron and Cade were jammed in close, their eyes on the rearing cliffs and what lay beyond. Grubb took up the middle bench, and Fen was at the back, her green hood thrown up over her head. Her expression was dour and her eyes far away, the better to conceal her fear. But Aaron sensed it anyway. He knew her well enough by now.
"Why Grubb always end up rowing?" the skull grumbled.
"You volunteered, you idiot," Cade told him, "after boasting how much stronger you are than all of us." Grubb considered that.
"Still not seem fair," he muttered.
Aaron barely heard their bickering. His eyes were on Hammerholt, a league distant or less, its upper reaches visible through a break in the cliffs. Even the mellow afternoon light and the hazy streamers of mist couldn't soften it. It was a sloped pile of walls and angles, dizzying in scale, crouched formidably among the peaks. Battlements piled upon battlements, with parapets like teeth, and square towers guarding every corner. There was hardly a curve on it, and nothing of glamour or glory. It was as solid as the mountains, a blunt statement of power. This was the keystone of Ossia, the point upon which all the country's might rested. Had Queen Alessandra Eventongue made her stand here, had she not been caught by surprise in a lesser fortress, the invasion might have gone very differently. Aaron felt a chill of nervous excitement at seeing their destination. Like Fen, he was afraid, but he had a ferocious certainty that she lacked. So much could go wrong, there were so many bad ends to this adventure, yet he believed in his heart they'd win out. He believed it with the kind of brash confidence he'd felt when he faced down Ruffa, Clisson, and Wilhelm. He may have cast aside the Croden god, and the aspects had yet to convince him, but he was a man of faith nonetheless. A man, not a boy. Not any more. Sometime in the last few days there had been a change. He was centred, calm, self-possessed. No more was he his father's son, no longer a burden to others. His choices were his own now, and if they went to their deaths tonight, at least he'd die free. Grubb brought the boat into the shadow of the cliffs that edged the lake. They'd purchased it with Mara's money from a village on the far shore, hardly visible now in the mist. Fishing craft bobbed in the centre of the lake, but they didn't see a soul as they made their way along the barnacled feet of the cliffs, searching among the folds of rock. Somewhere here was an entrance to the caves, promised by the old map that Yarin had left them. By now the water should have lowered enough to reveal it. If the map was right. If Mara's calculations were correct. If.